Buddhist Summer School, Thursday, 28th August 1980. Venerable sirs and friends, one question has been submitted to me. If karma has nothing to do with rebirth, can you give your reasons for living a moral or good life? I think I tried to explain day before yesterday, or was it yesterday, that karma acts instantaneously all the time. This pulse of creation is the primordial energy acting in eternity, and it acts in a pulse of creation, a pulse of life, other life. I prefer not to use the word death. It's a pulse of life, other life. And it works with extreme rapidity. It works in a manner which produces a new creation every time the pulsation goes. It is non-repetitive. That is to say, it does not reproduce the old universe, nor does it utilize the old material as such. There is a complete transmutation of the whole universe, not a transformation, a rearranging of the furniture in a room, so to say, but it's a complete transmutation of the entire universe. And this is the extraordinary meaning of true creation. We know only procreation, biological and cultural. All our artistic and scientific and philosophical products are procreative. For this reason, whatsoever is procreation can be related to the past from which it emerges. It is true to type. All symphonies are symphonies. All sonnets are sonnets. They are new up to a point, but they are true to type. That is procreating, just as human beings biologically procreate other human beings. But creation is absolutely new every time. This is extremely difficult to visualize. And the pulse, as I said, works with tremendous rapidity. This is the fundamental meaning of the word karma, derived from kri, which means not merely to do or to make, but to create. And it creates out of the void, the primordial void. So there is no material already to start with, material of any sort. And creative activity produces the universe, and all the time it is changing from moment to moment, from split second to split second, with amazing rapidity. That is the important thing to bear in mind. Now, that which comes at the next pulse is the outcome, in a sense, only in a sense, of that which went before. So karma works immediately. Take a practical case in our own lives. We experience an emotion, say, a powerful emotion. That emotion affects immediately the brain, the Douglas glands, the nervous system, and so forth. It has an immediate effect. And the effect is so immediate that we are unable to register it in consciousness through the use of our brains as such. This is one of the great mysteries. Don't ask me to explain, give you a detailed rationale of it. I don't know. What I have said is something which I can hardly claim to know, but it came to me that way. And that is why I say it, you see. And this is the real meaning of karma. This karma is a-causal, it is a-rational. There is no consequence. Transcendence has no consequence. If transcendence is, produces some terrible catastrophe, it is not evil. If it produces some tremendous happiness, a Garden of Eden, it is not consequential. It just is like that. Absolute. Well now, actually rebirth has nothing to do with karma. The teaching of reincarnation, rebirth, came into being in order to explain various things to satisfy the intellect as such. Why was this fellow born lame or poor or in misery? Why is that person in such and such a condition and so forth? They say, so they invented this doctrine of rebirth, of reincarnation and so forth. It is derived in its essence from the beliefs of the proto-Australoid peoples of India. That was the second great migration. The Negritos were the first. The proto-Australoids were the second great migration. And they had a very interesting belief. They believed in an indestructible life essence. At death, that went into the soil, became one with the universal life essence, and it came up in trees and in animals. If a pregnant woman ate the fruit of that tree or the vegetable or whatever it was, or that animal, that life essence animated the fetus in her womb, and that was the new child. It was ideas like that which prevailed, 8,000 years ago in India. Those were the proto-Australoid beliefs. When the Aryan-speaking peoples spread over India and established kingdoms, and they as the overlords naturally were the rulers, these people who believed in these things had become their serfs. And so they started in the course of the centuries talking with each other about this, investigating this. The proto-Australoid groups were more intelligent. They were wily, if you like. They knew how to deal with their Aryan overlords. And so they invented this this kind of explanation. And the greater part of the Brahmin caste evolved as a result of this interaction between the primitive inhabitants of India and the Aryan-speaking overlords. So the idea of rebirth, reincarnation, came into being that way. And it was a very convenient way of trying to explain to all people, Aryan-speaking people included, the migrants as well as the original people, that this is why you are going through this sort of condition in life and you are going through this other sort of condition in life. It is a fact that was the case. And so the doctrine of rebirth found acceptance because it was a very plausible explanation. But a plausible explanation is not necessarily the truth as such. The existential person, the psychophysical being, completely dies. Shape, rupa, vedana, all the way, sanya, sankhara, vijnana, they are all perishing. We are, as existential being, constant perishers and total perishers. Make no mistake about that. You see, we like to cling to our egoistic feeling, our egoistic passion, to continue somewhere, somehow. And we invent all sorts of beliefs that, oh, but the divine spirit in me is the immortal. In a sense, yes. But if you look into it carefully, you will find that your mind is talking in quite the wrong way about it. The divine spirit belongs to the context of the infinite, the eternal, the immortal. It animates, in a sense, the whole of the psychophysical organism, which is confined to the finite, the temporal, and the mortal. And this psychophysical organism completely dies. Where does the I am I consciousness emerge from? It emerges out of our existential existence, of our existential being as such. And it is a thought which we put out to express our passion to hold on, to continue to be forever and ever as we are. You see, if I were to say, I will be reborn next time somewhere, or I was born in the past somewhere, this I refers to the name Firoz Mehta. But Firoz Mehta, the I am I consciousness, which is associated with Firoz Mehta, completely vanishes when the whole of the existential being has disintegrated, completely disintegrated. We are fearful of accepting the fact of death. We try to put our face against it and fight it and so forth. We fear death above all. Marana is one of the supreme problems which the Buddha solved, actually. But conventional Buddhism does not solve it. There are no conventional religion. The ordinary doctrines do not solve that problem at all. Now, if karma has nothing to do with rebirth, can you give your reasons for living a moral or a good life? Let me put it this way. Supposing you loved somebody very dearly, your husband, your wife, your child, your parent, your friend, your relative, your co-worker, or whoever it is. Would you do him any harm? Would you be happy hurting him? Would you steal what is his? Would you indulge yourself at his cost and expense in any sense, sensuous manner? Would you tell him lies? Or try to deceive him in any way? Would you even speak a harsh word to him? You wouldn't. I can never forget my own father. He never even spoke a harsh word to me, leave alone smack me or anything like that. Never even spoke a harsh word all his life. It's something which I can never forget. And in that experience, I realized one of the deep meanings of underneath are the everlasting arms. He was always like that. If I was about to make any mistakes or do something which would produce difficulty or break my toys or anything, he would say, Sonny, I think you won't be happy with the result of this. And if I still persisted and did it, he would say, now let us put it all together, or I'll get a new one for you. And that was the sort of man he was, completely loving. So now, as we see, you wouldn't want to tell a lie or speak a harsh word or slander one whom you love. Isn't that sufficient dynamic power for the living of the moral life, the good life? Now, in the same way, if we can see, if we have a real social sense, we'll have a sense not in terms of you and I, of myself and the other fellow, but we'll have a social sense in terms of us, some, at first it is naturally restricted to the family. Then you extend it to the community, to your own nation, to all mankind ultimately. You include all mankind in that sense of us. Would you harm us? Because oneself is also included in that. You don't want to harm yourself. You don't want to steal from yourself. You don't want to be untruthful to yourself. If you do, well, do. Do it and see what happens. Karma will work pretty swiftly. We have a conscience. Every one of us is endowed with a conscience. Some people seem to be conscienceless. But the fact is that everyone is endowed with a conscience for the very simple reason that our moral imperative derives from the transcendent and universal source, which was beautifully represented in the Rig Veda in the person of the god Varuna. Varuna was the moral governor of the universe. He was the first of the great gods of the Rig Veda. Now you see, it's very significant, isn't it? And it is from, and also from the fact that in the Rig Veda we have this teaching of Ritta. I did mention Ritta during the course of this week. The eternal order of things, which is inherent in everyone and in everything. That is why our moral imperative derives from that transcendent source. We can flout it, we can go against it willfully, but in the end, we will find only sorrow for ourselves and still worse for those who are around us. Now, what then about living a moral and a good life? And in fact, I don't want to give reasons for living a moral life. It is real happiness to live a moral and good life. There is no other true source of real happiness excepting living the good and the moral life. Then you are truly a human being. Remember the meaning of the word human. The word human means the blissful creator. Hu and man. The root man means, in the dictionary you'll be told it means to think, which is not really inaccurate. And hu, the prefix hu, which is interchangeable with the prefix su, means happy, something well done. The Buddha is talked of as the Sugata, he who has gone happily, gone well. So, the word human really means the blissful creator, because it is mind, from the root man is derived the word man as well as the word mind. And mind is the creative source in us. We know that. And it is also the universal creative source. That archetypal form of the creative energy which releases cosmos into being. Harmony, well-being, and so forth. That's the meaning of the word human. And it is this, it is the fruition of our humanity that we arrive at through living the good life, the pure life. Consider all the great religions of the world. Where do they find a common point of agreement? In the moralities that they laid down. All the great religions laid down the same morality. There's no getting away from that. Primitive peoples and primitive religions also laid down the morality as the fundamental basis for living the human life and arriving at human fulfillment in the true sense of the word. If you like to call that a reason, well, all right. But do it for the love of the thing. live happily, live beautifully, live purely, because it is something which you love to do. Where you love, you don't want any reasons. It is so. You know, there was a delightful little cartoon or something, I think, many, many years ago in Punch. There are two little African children, a boy and a girl. And the one says, "Why do I love you?" And the other replies, "Because I do." Well, love the world, love creation, love yourself too. You can't love your neighbor if you hate yourself. You can't love your neighbor if you do that. If you hate yourself, then your love for your neighbor will be a dependent love, and you will draw upon him instead of being totally loving towards him. It's this unreserved giving of oneself to another, reciprocally and unconditionally, which is pure love and true love. And if you love life, if you love truth, beauty, goodness, anything you like to call it, well then, you will live the moral life, the good life. You will hardly need to define your morality. You will know it. There's something in you which will tell you, the moral imperative in you, which derives from transcendence itself, will tell you all about it. All right? Well, now, I've just mentioned that that all the great religions have meet where the moralities are concerned, the living of the good life, the pure life. Hold fast to that. Treasure it. Treasure it in your own light, the light of your own experience, your own vision. And that way, you will find that you will succeed in living the good life. If you try to follow the good life because somebody else has laid down that do this, think that, believe this, and you will lead the good life, you will always come across difficulties. Because mere beliefs which are imposed from outside are of no avail whatsoever. It is what you yourself see from within your own being, through your own living experience, and your experience, if it is related to a love for that which is, the totality which is, if it is derived from that, then your goodness will be a true goodness, and you'll be able to live by it. And it will change. It must change. Because our first conceptions of the good life and so forth are imperfect conceptions. And experience enables us to change the conceptions of goodness as we grow. And we discard the lesser condition, or rather I should say, the lesser condition is transformed, transmuted into the more developed and purer condition. This is one of the great significances of death. Death is the means for an autopoiesis, which is a self-changing into a more advanced form of being. This autopoietic activity characterizes the universal process. Poiesis is a Greek word which means change. Changing. So, hold fast to the good life, the moral life, in accordance with your own vision. Of course, friends, teachings, religions, philosophies, they can all help. Don't philosophize too much. Otherwise, you will merely be a philosophist instead of a true philosopher, a lover of wisdom. And unless you are a natural philosopher, you will lack the wisdom which enables the love of the truth to flower out. Now we come to our last meeting this year. Whatsoever hath an uprising and origin, by nature also hath an ending, said the enlightened one. Now I can't say anything better than that. So we come to an end in the ordinary physical sense. You will all be going to your own homes. We will all be going to our own homes, and it will seem as if this thing has ended. In a sense, it has ended, yes. But in another sense, it has not ended. You have come here out of love, let me see. Out of appreciation, out of kindness, out of courtesy, and we have met together, and I have in my tiny way tried to present certain things which may be of use to you in living your own lives. That will always remain with us. I have learned from each and every one of you without your knowing it. You see, that's why I have paid no fees for the teaching which you have given me. But it really has been for me a very great happiness indeed, and a very great honor to have the presence of our bhikkhus here at every meeting, except yesterday when, of course, I don't suppose they can levitate, so they couldn't have come over from Chithurst by levitation to attend the meeting. But I'm sure their hearts and spirits were also with us. And I want to thank each and every one of you very much indeed. It has been a great joy, and also, up to a point, quite hard work. Because this year, it hasn't been too easy for me to do this. Last year it was much easier because I was in a much fitter condition physically. And of course, when one is in a fitter condition physically, one's brain works more smoothly. This time my brain has not worked smoothly. It has found difficulties. But your goodness and kindness towards me has sustained me in my efforts, and I am indeed very, very grateful to all of you. I owe you very much indeed, and I don't, and I know that I cannot repay such things. In any case, we mustn't think in terms of repayment. What is given in love freely must be accepted with love freely. I would like the second sila to be worded this way: refrain from taking what is not freely given. Not just what is not given, but what is not freely given. Given with love, not grudgingly. That is the important point. So, when you go back into the storm and stress of the outer world, again, take from here this wonderful atmosphere that we have of peace, and we have been very lucky to have peace in weather-wise also. No storms or rain to spoil your outdoor activities, which you have been enjoying here. take that with you into the outer world and try and keep in your innermost consciousness an awakenedness with respect to what of the truth of Buddhism you have been able to gather during this week. And you will find that without your knowing it, you will be a benediction to those in your home, to those around you, and to the whole world as such. Because whatsoever goes forth from us affects not only our immediate surroundings, which we can see, but it affects the whole world. That is the nature of the physical world itself. We have to thank modern science for showing that very, very clearly, way down, right into the subatomic realms. There is this continuous interaction going on, an interaction of such a nature that in order to understand any one thing fully, you have to know all about every other thing. Science itself shows the impossibility of attaining an intellectual knowledge of the totality of things, or even of any one thing to its fullest degree. This interplay and interrelationship is so great and so wonderful. So too, there is this interplay and interrelationship between us human beings, whom we usually talk of as you and I. But let the you, let the I, as separate entities, disappear. Let them just dissolve out of our consciousness altogether and be filled with the sense of us. And as I say, you will find evidence coming up later on, not immediately, but later on, of how you have been a benediction to the world in which you live, for which, of course, we must be very grateful, above all, to the great teacher himself, the enlightened one, the Buddha. So thank you all very, very much, and peace and happiness be with all of you, every one of you.